Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
In India, monsoon season is no longer what it used to be.
We are having long dry spells and then suddenly short spells of heavy rains.
That's making the deluge more dangerous. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, what communities there are doing to be resilient. Also, with more countries saying they want to recognize a Palestinian state, we look at an old idea making a comeback, the two-state solution.
What this approach does is say, hey, we recognize that Israel-Palestine is the homeland to both peoples.
Plus, a giant insect discovered in Australia, swimmers breaking world records, and in Cambodia.
The rats are trained to smell the explosives.
Bomb-sniffing rats.
All that and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for making it here today. This time of year means one thing in much of South Asia, monsoon season, torrential rains from June to September.
Pakistan has seen major flooding and landslides in recent weeks. Some places received more than double the rainfall compared to the same time period last year. 260 people have died. On one especially wet day, the rain triggered flash floods that inundated several villages, killing at least 54 people in just 24 hours. Extreme rain has caused the drainage to fill up, this TV newscaster told viewers in Rawalpindi.
The monsoon has been even deadlier this year in neighboring India. Part of what's happening, climate change is altering monsoon season and making it more dangerous. Sushmita Pathak has our story from Delhi.
In Ravi Dutt's tailoring shop, men are hunched over sewing machines. The small establishment in Delhi is near the Yamuna River that runs through the city. The river is not visible from the shop. A busy road and a clump of trees separate them. But 2 years ago, the river ran right through it. Dutt recalls the panic he felt as he saw the floodwaters gush into the shop. His furniture, sewing machines and customers' clothes were ruined. The water was up to my neck, he says. 2 years ago, the Yamuna River rose to an all-time high as rainfall in Delhi broke a 41-year record. Intense rainfall like this is becoming more common across India, says Roxy Matthew Cole, a climate scientist at the Indian Institute of Tropical Meteorology.
So instead of moderate rains spread through the season, we are having long dry spells and then suddenly short spells of heavy rains.
Imagine a month's worth of rain falling over a few hours. Cole's research shows that extreme rainfall events have increased threefold in India over the last 70 years. He says it's a clear indication of climate change.
Warmer the air, it holds more moisture, and it holds for a longer time.
Warming oceans lead to more evaporation. Warmer air holds onto that moisture for longer, dumping it all at once. Improved forecasting can help prepare for the worst. But in the tropics, storms form quickly and move fast, says Cole, making prediction inherently more difficult than in more temperate regions. Climate change adds another layer of complexity, and forecasters are struggling to keep up.
If there is more energy in the system, like due to global warming, climate change and all, there's more temperature, more moisture, it makes the system much more unstable. So as our technical prowess, our understanding is improving, climate change is making it much more difficult to forecast some of these systems.
Rising urbanization is also a problem. When extreme rainfall lashes a city, the water has fewer and fewer places to run off. Indian cities are taking over floodplains and green spaces that would normally absorb the flow. Moreover, drainage systems in Delhi and other cities are several decades old. Their capacity is no longer enough to carry the amount of rain they're receiving, says Nitin Bassi. He's with the think tank Council on Energy, Environment and Water.
those drainages were built considering rainfall events of the past, and now the rainfall has changed.
He says cities need to redesign their drainage systems. Many don't have separate drains for storm water. Sewage and solid waste clog the drains, leading to frequent waterlogging. Bassi says municipal authorities must ensure that drains are cleaned properly.
They need to be desilted on time. And we should not wait for this yearly cycle that, you know, we will clean these drains just before the monsoon. Because the arrival of monsoon itself is shifting.
Plans to upgrade Delhi's drainage system are in the works. The Indian capital has also introduced permeable pavements in some areas, says Bassi. And like concrete, they allow rainwater to percolate into the ground. Meanwhile, the southern Indian city of Chennai is focusing on restoring marshes. Floods killed more than 250 people there in 2015. Solutions should also involve more localized rainfall monitoring, says Bassi.
In a city, you won't find a lot of wards having, let's say, their own rain gauges. Now, this is important because rainfall is getting extremely localized.
India's weather department issues citywide alerts, but hyper-local monitoring and flood warning may not be feasible for government agencies. That's where citizens like Ebi Emmanuel come in. Emmanuel lives in India's southernmost state of Kerala, where the monsoon first makes landfall. He oversees a large network of volunteers who monitor rainfall and river flows in the Meenachil River Basin.
Our involvement and engagement is a must. And we have to keep ourselves safe with our own vigilance and our own initiatives also.
School children, farmers, homemakers measure rainfall through rain gauges, simple cylindrical devices set up in their backyards. Scales painted on bridges and rocks help volunteers track river flow. The data is shared with the local community through a WhatsApp group, and it has helped save lives.
Actually, in 2020, we were able to evacuate 100 families from the western side of the river. And actually, there was no alerts by any of the official agencies. There was no heavy rain in that area, but in the hilly region, there was extreme rain.
The residents were hesitant to move at first, but evacuated eventually. That night, the area was flooded, Emmanuel says. The group first realized the importance of real-time monitoring in 2018, when torrential rains triggered massive flooding in Kerala, killing more than 400 people. Rainfall reporting by members all along the river basin helped people make life-saving decisions.
Immediately after, we got a lot of thanks messages in the group. So really that motivated us and that really reminded us about the responsibility.
It fueled the river and rainfall monitoring initiative. Now, during peak monsoon, the information collected by the group is published in local newspapers. Disaster management authorities use it too. And researchers are helping the group improve data collection and documentation. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak, Delhi.
Monsoons in India can also trigger deadly landslides. Tune in tomorrow when Sushmita looks at the challenges of using early warning systems in the country's mountainous regions as rainstorms become more erratic.
Calm has returned to Cambodia following a truce with Thailand. The two countries have been battling over the border between them. Many Cambodians hope the fighting is over for good. Their nation is dangerous enough without it. Cambodia is strewn with landmines and unexploded bombs left behind by conflicts that ended decades ago. As the world's Patrick Nguyen reports, professional demining teams there are getting some help from some very small friends.
A metal detector sweeping over sun-baked dirt. The Cambodian man holding it is clad in black body armor. He's a D-miner. Finding landmines from old wars can be a painstaking task. Just ask Mick Rains. He's a veteran D-mining specialist.
With traditional metal detecting methods, the metal detector picks up every single small piece of metal, which has to be excavated and checked to see if it is a landmine.
Rains is based in Cambodia, one of the most heavily mined countries in the world. He's with an organization called APOPO. That's an acronym that, in Belgian, means Anti-Personnel Landmine Detection Product Development. This group has revolutionized demining by offloading much of the work to rodents.
The rats are trained to actually smell the explosives within the mine.
Rats are notoriously good at sniffing and they're easy to train. Mick Rain says they'll stroll right into a minefield as long as you give them their favorite treats.
Peanuts and bananas.
But aren't the rats unknowingly risking their lives for peanuts? Rain says, no, that's not how it works.
The operating pressure of an anti-personnel mine is around about 5 to 7 kilograms.
That means even a small kid playing in Cambodia's rice fields could trigger a landmine. Rats cannot.
With our rats only weighing 1.2 kilograms, they can go straight over the top of it and it won't detonate the mine.
The rats of Apopo support the Cambodian government's demining operations by making them safer and much faster. Picture a patch of land the size of a basketball court. A human with a metal detector might take 4 days to sweep that area. A rat can clear it in about 20 minutes. Apopo's co-founder, Christoph Cox, says when they first proposed the idea of bomb-sniffing rats, some people thought they'd lost their minds.
And it took really more than a decade for the industry to take us serious.
Originally from Belgium, Cox started this project in sub-Saharan Africa more than 20 years ago. Apopo has put rats to work in Mozambique, Angola, Azerbaijan, Ukraine, and Cambodia. The U.S. pounded Cambodia with cluster bombs in the 60s and 70s. America wanted to keep communism from spreading out of Vietnam. It didn't work. A communist regime called the Khmer Rouge took over, and then it littered the country with landmines as it was pushed out of power. Cox says mines, cluster bombs, it doesn't matter. They both give off a vapor that rats can sniff. Apopo's preferred species is the African giant pouched rat.
That lives underground, therefore it's like almost blind, so it relies even more on its smelling capacity.
And Cox is proud to say, of the hundreds of rats his organization has deployed, none has ever died in action. A typical day at work for one of Apopo's 48 rats in Cambodia. They get started very early when it's cooler outside. Mick Rains says the rats don't care for the country's raging midday heat.
Before the start work, we always put suntan lotion on their ears and on their tails to protect them.
A rat on a leash will find buried explosives. They'll scratch the dirt, marking the spot. Then deminers go out with metal detectors to confirm the finding. Landmines can be removed with little shovels. But big bombs require experts with Cambodia's government. They'll clear them with a controlled detonation. But by the time bombs are going off, the rats will already be back home at Apopo's Cambodian headquarters, resting up their noses for the next outing. The rats live in a large air-conditioned enclosure, alongside rat retirees who've grown too old to work.
We let the rats live their lives out. They get exercise each day, and we have a big cage for them to run around in where they can, just enjoy themselves.
Apopo's goal, wherever it works, is always to keep going until the country is virtually landmine-free, a goal it did help Mozambique reach in 2015. The nearly 50 rats active in Cambodia still have busy schedules. Rains says it will take many years before the country is finally landmine-free. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Australia is known for having really big things and really unusual wildlife, freaky, you might even say, and a discovery by scientists in Queensland confirms both reputations.
Acrophylla alta is a ginormous stick insect. Ginormous, not exactly a scientific descriptor, but an accurate one. Angus Emmett of James Cook University and fellow scientist Ross Coupland got a tip that the previously unknown insect existed, and they managed to capture one on video, which they shared with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
In the frame, you can see that the insect is as long as the forearm of the man holding it. Its head is at the palm of his hand, and its light brown tail reaches all the way back to his elbow. Its six spindly legs are each several inches long. For a bug, this thing is huge.
It's the wings that impress me. They unfurl kind of like an accordion fan, big and brown and mottled. But it still does what stick insects do best. You can see a picture where it totally blends in with a branch on the tree.
Acrophila alta is now believed to be Australia's heaviest insect, this one weighing in at 44 grams, about the same as 2 US quarters. The scientists' findings have been published in the journal Zootaxa.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Investigations, protests, and now a resignation. Lithuania's Prime Minister Gintautas Paluckas stepped down today after less than a year on the job. He's denied any wrongdoing, but says scandals surrounding him were interfering with government work.
Recent media investigations have kept the prime minister's past and present business and financial dealings top of mind, including details about a 2012 court case known as the rat poison scandal. That's when Paluckas was convicted of mishandling the bidding process for rat extermination services when he was city administrator for the capital, Vilnius.
The prime minister's cabinet is also expected to resign. Coalition talks to form a new cabinet are expected soon. Staying in the Baltic states, let's turn our attention now to Estonia, a pioneer among European countries in digitizing government services. It may sound like a small thing, but it's a point of local pride in Estonia that all government services can be conveniently accessed online. Whereas Germany, for example, is still bogged down in lots of bureaucratic paperwork. Reporter Ben Botke from our partner DW Deutsche Welle brings us the story of how Estonia has achieved 100% digital status.
The last part of civic life to go online? Divorce. As of last December, you can end your marriage online too.
This is a screenshot of my marriage relationship, and I had to do this with my wife present.
That's Lukas Ilves, former chief information officer of the Estonian government.
The scary thing is you click that button and you start pressing next, next, next. It takes 45 seconds to get to the point where it's like, submit the application. The other person also has to submit the application. So you can't quite divorce in 45 seconds.
Ilves is the author of a new study published with support of Germany's Friedrich Naumann Foundation. The study aims to see where Germany, a country where only 62% of the population uses digital government services, can learn from Estonia, where the uptake is over 90%. The answer is a lot. Take electronic identity verification, for example. 90% of Estonians use national EIDs to access government services, compared to less than 10% of Germans. Why? To Ilves, the answer is simple. The Estonian version is reliable, user-friendly, and can be used for both public and private sector services like banking.
Belgium has an EID that is technologically very similar to Germany's. For a very long time, had 10 or 20% of people using it. A few years ago, the banks and the telcos got together. They produced a very user-friendly mobile version of that EID that could be used both to log on to banks and to private sector services and for government services. And they got in 2 years to 80% uptake of the EID.
And the incentives for investing in a system that works are big. According to Ilves' study, Estonia currently spends 1/6 of what Germany spends on collecting tax revenue. And it's not just about efficiency savings either. Transparency and accountability are important too. According to the 2024 e-government monitor by nonprofit network D21, 80% of citizens who see their lives simplified by the state have great or very great trust in the state. That's compared to a population average of only 38%.
My name is Magdalena Zadara. I am Chief of Staff and Strategy at the German Digital Service.
Zadara and her 200 colleagues at the German Digital Service, founded in 2020 under then-Chancellor Angela Merkel, develop and implement software to digitalize administrative processes like online court procedures.
Currently, German government thinks about services in responsibilities. So they break every service down into different Zuständigkeiten, they call it in German. And that leads to very fragmented user journeys where things don't even use the same language oftentimes because different government offices are developing different parts of this journey. If I wanted to come to Germany to work from a country outside the EU, I would have to interact with probably about 5 to 7 different government agencies to get my diploma approved, to get a visa, etc. And they would maybe even ask for the same data of me.
This last bit is one of the most time-consuming and annoying aspects of having to deal with bureaucracy in Germany, as the author of this report can tell you a thing or two about. In Estonia, the so-called once-only principle, the idea that the government should reuse the data it already possesses instead of requiring individuals and businesses to resubmit information, is one of the pillars of the digital government. It's even codified in law.
What was the first time you used the digital signature? When was that? when I became a resident in 2015, and it was actually super easy. In Russia, even though it existed at the time, I was never able to go through the verification process because it was so complicated, completely unusable. Basically, in Estonia, it was like, yeah, okay, just get the card, you plug it in, and it works. It's magic.
That's Estonian-Russian entrepreneur Kirill Solovyov talking to me at an exhibition in Tallinn titled Why Estonia? From the USSR to E-Estonia. After Estonia, together with Latvia and Lithuania, regained its independence from the Soviet Union in 1991, Estonia brought the internet and computers to every classroom and library across the country in what became known as the Tiger Leap. The country of 1.3 million people took another big step in 2000 when online tax declarations became available and electronic signatures were recognized as legally equivalent to paper ones. By 2015, all major public services, including health and social services, had been fully digitized.
How do the digital prescriptions work in a nutshell?
You basically go to the doctor, and if they prescribe medicine, it's put into the online registry. And then you go to any pharmacy anywhere in Estonia, and also in Finland, by the way. And then you just pull out your ID card, you give it to the pharmacist, and they see exactly what has been prescribed, the different like options you have. It's instant verification. You cannot go wrong because it's all digital. There's no deciphering illegible handwriting that's so common with doctors in some parts of the world. So like, it's easy, it's safe, and it's fast.
And no way of tampering with it, really.
I mean, no tampering.
But there is concern about tampering at an EU level. Europe's tech industry has been calling on EU lawmakers to reduce reliance on foreign-owned big tech like Google or Amazon by developing a so-called Eurostack, which would encompass everything from critical resources like energy, computer chips, and other hardware to cloud, communication, and data infrastructure, as well as AI. But Lukas Ilves, the author of the report about digitalization in Estonia and Germany, warns of the high opportunity costs of what he calls reinventing the wheel and labeling everything from the US a risk.
We need to be much more concrete in focusing on very specific risks. Estonia, of course, is a small country, never decided to build an end-to-end Estonia stack. We built very specific applications and protocols on top of the global technology stack. And the question for Europe is, do we actually think we can succeed end-to-end building everything? I don't think so. No country can be autarkic and fully sovereign in the digital world. So we have to be smart with the Euro stack.
If European administrative behemoths like Germany are to keep up in the digital age, they could have a lot to learn from small and nimble countries like Estonia, even if it means divorcing online in only 45 seconds.
Reporter Ben Botke for our partners, DW. Longtime listeners to The World might remember our popular GeoQuiz segment in which we tested your knowledge of geography and current events.
And if you're a more recent fan of The World, good news, the GeoQuiz is back on our new YouTube channel. Carolyn and I have been stumped more than once.
And now I'm wondering if I'm getting this country confused with its next door neighbor.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Oh, I'm questioning everything.
I am too. This is really hard.
No softballs in the Geo Quiz. Watch us squirm. If you are curious which country had us confused, check out the latest Geo Quiz on YouTube. Find us at The World News GBH.
You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, We aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. A few updates for you on Ukraine, Russia, and the war they are fighting.
Ukraine's parliament passed a bill today that restores independence to two anti-corruption watchdogs. This reverses a controversial move President Volodymyr Zelensky made last week that curbed their power. Spontaneous and vocal public protests ensued in Ukraine, joined by criticism from the EU and human rights groups, significantly tarnishing Zelensky's reputation. Ukraine hopes to join the European Union, but it is to make progress on entrenched corruption first.
Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a bill today that punishes people for searching for, quote, extremist materials online. In Russia, the official definition of extremist activity is broad. It includes LGBTQ organizations and the Anti-Corruption Foundation, started by the late opposition leader Alexei Navalny. It's not clear how authorities will track down violators.
Meanwhile, the fighting between Russia and Ukraine continues. Russian missile and drone attacks overnight on Kyiv killed at least 13 people and wounded 132 others, authorities said today. Ukraine reportedly was firing back. Russia's defense ministry says that it had shot down 32 Ukrainian drones overnight.
Canada has joined France and the UK in saying it plans to formally recognize a Palestinian state. Prime Minister Mark Carney explained yesterday.
Canada has long been committed to a two-state solution. An independent, viable, and sovereign Palestinian state living side by side with the state of Israel in peace and security.
The two-state solution is something we used to hear about a lot in Middle East diplomacy. And after basically being put on ice, it is coming up again.
We asked two scholars to help us sort out what recognizing a Palestinian state means and whether a two-state solution is even feasible. Mira Sukharov has worked on three books about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She's a political scientist at Carleton University in Ottawa. And Omar Dejani has been a legal advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team in peace talks with Israel. He teaches law at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. They are also working together on a book, which means their collaboration sometimes mirrors the tensions they are writing about. We spoke this afternoon, and Mira started by explaining how people in the community she is a part of are reacting to Canada's plan to recognize a Palestinian state.
The organized Jewish community is not happy, and I think the organized Jewish community is trying to portray this move as a punishment to Israel and as what they call rewarding Hamas terrorism. And I think what's really important to see here is that two things. One is that the organized Jewish community puts out statements. We have a very centralized Israel lobby here that's tied to Jewish federations in Canada in a way that isn't in the U.S., and that Israel lobby is called the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. They put out a line saying that many Jews feel this way. And I think it's really important to point out that many Jews might feel this way, but many Jews also don't feel this way. And I'm a Jew. I'm also an analyst. And what I see here is that recognizing a Palestinian state is not a punishment. Everybody in the Middle East, among Israelis and Palestinians, needs to be free for the other to be free.
Omar, what are you hearing? And specifically, what are you hearing on the idea that recognition of Palestine is rewarding Hamas?
I think where people's hearts are in relation to this right now is there's the sense among Palestinians of at last key European countries, members of the G7 like Canada as well, are taking a stand in favor of Palestinian self-determination. But I think just this real weariness and the constant news cycle, every morning dozens of people killed at aid distribution sites by either Israeli forces or American contractors. Just today, we saw that Marco Rubio, U.S. Secretary of State, has announced sanctions against the Palestinian Authority for trying to pursue justice in international tribunals. And the sense is, why are we being sanctioned? Why is the world standing by and making symbolic gestures, even if they are poignant, at this moment where what we really need is action to press Israel to desist from the path that it's on.
So let's move from the actions taken by and considered by several countries to recognize a Palestinian state, a state that would be called Palestine, to the idea of a two-state solution. Where do the two of you differ when it comes to the feasibility of a two-state solution to the conflict? Mira, I gather you were an advocate of this idea years ago, but you've changed. Why?
I've shifted in a couple different directions. I used to be, as you said, a strong advocate of a conventional two-state solution. Then I think it was around the 2015 elections in Israel when people were optimistic that there would be a change, and there wasn't. And over time, the government in Israel has become increasingly more right-wing. And over time, I started to feel that what we needed was just to institute democracy now across the whole area. And I don't disagree with myself on that. We do need democracy now. But I've come to embrace an approach that goes back to the two-state solution idea, but with serious modifications. And that's known as a confederal approach. And I'll let Omar elaborate more on that, because he's very active in one of the movements that really presses for that vision.
Yeah. Can you explain more, Omar?
Both Mira and I are involved in a movement called A Land for All, or Two States, One Homeland. It is a two-state solution that can actually work. It's cognizant of the ways in which earlier attempts to reach a two-state solution have faltered. I mentioned earlier the challenge of Israeli settlements, also the question of what to do with Palestinian refugees, many hundreds of thousands of whom seek realization of their right of return to their homes in what's now Israel. The idea is that there would be a Palestinian state established alongside Israel, with a border based on the pre-1967 line, just as the international community has long advocated. Both states would have a capital in Jerusalem. Both peoples would have passports. Each state would have a seat at the United Nations. The only difference, and it's a crucial difference, is that the border between these two states would be one over which movement, and eventually, once security and economics allow, where movement and residence is liberalized so that a Palestinian like me could become a citizen of the state of Palestine, but could become a permanent resident of the state of Israel. An Israeli could continue to live, for example, in the settlement of Ariel in the northern West Bank, but that settlement would become a city in the state of Palestine, and that person would be living there as a permanent resident of Palestine. And so the idea here is to take an approach that works really well in a lot of places, not just in the European Union, where it's existed for a lot of years, or in the UK and Ireland, but also in other parts of the world, in Latin America, in West Africa.
I mean, I'm sure you both recognize the many vested interests that would be determined to sabotage that sort of effort. I mean, I think of the voice of Israeli foreign minister I'd like to hear right now, Gideon Saar, who this week spoke, like many Israelis, defiantly opposed to this idea.
We are aware of the fact that there are countries in Europe today with a huge Muslim population. Sometimes it affects the policies of their governments, but this cannot and will not lead Israel to commit suicide. We won't allow a jihadist terror state in the heart of our ancient homeland.
Mira, how does the idea of recognition even then lead to a two-state solution if this is a position it's up against? Western countries appeasing their Muslim populations and a continuing false characterization of Palestinians as jihadists.
Sure. I mean, Israel has been moving rightward over the years, and there are many extremist, racist elements in Israel, in the government, who oppose freedom for Palestinians and who want to see the occupation continue forever and ever and ever. They don't call it occupation, but they have no desire to remove Israeli troops from the West Bank, to remove checkpoints. So the question is, are we just going to sit by and listen to extremist voices continue these policies of oppression with likely more and more October 7ths happening in the future, or are we trying to make change?
Omar, how do you even start by squaring the circle?
The place to start is by starting to shift incentives for the Israeli government. And those disincentives can take the form of sanctions. They can take the form of the United States withholding its veto in forums like the United Nations Security Council. It can take the form of European states choosing not to renew their association agreement, which gives Israel very significant economic access to its markets, that there are costs to continuing down this path. That's the only way we can get beyond this.
We're speaking about the feasibility of a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with Mira Sukharov of Carleton University in Ottawa and Omar Dajani, a Palestinian-American professor of law at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. The two of you have been working together on this for a while, but that work, from what I understand, your collaboration has not been easy. I mean, that's understandable. I'd like to tease out a bit the differences in your vantage points here. And maybe to do that, it might help to look at your biographies. Mira, you spent 3 years living in Israel, including on a kibbutz. You speak fluent Hebrew. How does that inform your perspective on the conflict itself and the feasibility of a two-state solution?
My time in Israel and my time growing up in a tight-knit Jewish community in a couple of different cities in Canada makes me feel very invested in Israel's present and future. And I think because of that investment, I want to see change.
Take us into your own family members you're still close to on that kibbutz. I mean, how do they feel about the fact that this week, three American allies announced a step toward recognizing a Palestinian state?
One set of family I have on a kibbutz was the site of an attack on October 7th. They're understandably very wary of giving Hamas the keys, or they may view many, many, many Palestinians in general as supportive of October 7th and supportive of Hamas, but they also want to see a different future for their children and grandchildren.
Omar, tell us about your family's roots. Where was your father born? What were the circumstances and conditions that you've witnessed over time?
So my father was born in Palestine in 1932 in the city of Jaffa, which is now inside the state of Israel. And in April of 1948, his family was, along with most of the population of Jaffa, driven out of their city, which is a city that my family has lived in for centuries, by militias that would a month later become the Israel Defense Forces when Israel declared independence. My father's family became refugees in 1948, like around 750,000 other Palestinians and some 5 million now, including their descendants. There is a continuing attachment to the idea of Palestine and also to the specific place that we came from, to Jaffa. And I think that that attachment doesn't foreclose sharing that space. I think for many Palestinians, the desire is not to push anyone out, as many people believe, but instead to see recognized our own attachment to the place. My great-great-great-great-grandfather went to negotiate with Napoleon when he took the city of Jaffa at the end of the 18th century. Those are deep roots, and they're roots that we would like to see respected. The key thing to remember is that there's just not an alternative. I mean, the alternative to us finding a way to live with each other in equality and in peace in that space is either that one of the peoples has continuing supremacy, which goes against our values, or that one of the peoples is pushed out of the land, which is an even more outrageous proposition.
Let me shift gears now for just a bit and talk about your professional collaboration. Mira, how did that start?
I was back in another wave of conflict, which seemed at the time very grave. And now in retrospect, it's a drop in the bucket. And that was in May 2021 between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. And Omar had posted a piece on Facebook about his family's history and how Gaza became Gaza, which is to say that two-thirds of Palestinians in Gaza are refugees or descendants of refugees. And Omar published that piece, a short personal essay on Facebook, and I shared it. And from then, we began talking and exploring the idea of a collaboration. I think I was really ready at the time to bring a Palestinian voice into my writings, and Omar fortunately was open to having me bring my voice into his writings, and that became some common projects together. And that's right now we're working on a book together.
Yeah, I mean, you're both researchers. You're also friends. Has this collaboration felt scary at any point? I mean, Omar, I gather that you've both gotten some flack for it.
I mean, our political commitments are pretty similar, but our backgrounds and our emotional reactions are pretty different. And I've had people say, and I know that Mira has faced a lot of pressure too, is this the time to be doing is like, what possible value does dialogue have in a moment of genocide? What are you doing? Like, what's the point of this? That has been really hard for both of us at different junctures. But I will say that the contrary is also true, for me at least, that during this incredibly painful time when every morning brings horror, not just bad news, being able to process it with Mira, being able to be reminded of our common humanity, even after we fight about things, where we've had different reactions to developments, getting past that has really been fortifying for me. I mean, it's not only good when you have a good friend and you get past a fight, but when that good friend sits on the other side of the ethnic divide, getting past that fight also is somehow a vindication of, I think, our common view that we can overcome what's happening in Israel-Palestine. We can overcome the divisions between peoples that we're both attached to.
Mira, what do you think?
When Omar and I do retreat into our corners, it's painful and uncomfortable and unpleasant, and we often feel misunderstood by the other. Dialogue is very controversial in many Palestinian solidarity circles and among many activists because of the view that the enslaved person cannot dialogue with the enslaver, that the power asymmetry is so great that it's a sham, it's a farce, and it's just feeding into the deepening the power asymmetry. Now, we could say that Omar and I have a similar power asymmetry, him being Palestinian and me being Jewish, but because we're both in the diaspora, Omar's American, I'm Canadian, the power shifts quite a bit. I personally am not Israeli, and even if I were, I don't live there. There's ways that we can finesse that a little bit, but I think we both have a commitment to dialogue, but dialogue in a way that understands and embraces the knowledge of the power asymmetry, not a dialogue that flattens it all or ignores it.
What's been important for us is that we're not just engaged in dialogue, but that we also came to the conversation after really working to ensure that we were operating from similar values, not necessarily the same views about a lot of things, but similar values. And I think starting from that has made a huge difference for us as well.
Omar Dajani is a law professor at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. Mira Sukharov teaches political science at Carleton University in Ottawa. More coverage of the war in Gaza is online at theworld.org.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We go now to a small village in the hills of central Turkey, where the Alevi community, Turkey's largest religious minority, is starting to thrive. The Alevis are Muslims with different customs than the Sunni majority. They've endured centuries of discrimination in Turkey. And now, as part of their renaissance, one long-lost tradition is making a comeback. Reporter Uzge Sebzegi brings us the story from the village of Ayhanlar.
Around 200 villagers gather for a gem ceremony. It's the central ritual in Alevi spiritual life, combining music, prayer, and community. Men and women sit together, along with visitors from neighboring communities, in a brand new place of worship. It's called a Cemevi. Inside, the walls are lined with photos of sacred figures. Prophet Ali, the 12 Imams, and Hacı Bektaş Veli, a 13th century mystic who helped shape Alevi belief. The Zakir, the musician, plays a traditional stringed instrument and chants spiritual hymns. Then the community joins in prayer. Next, participants are asked if they have any unresolved conflict or hurt feelings toward one another. If someone has wronged another, this is the time to speak up. Only when all hearts are at peace can the gem ceremony continue. Then comes the Semah, a ritual dance where girls and boys spin and turn together in a circle. The girls wear long white dresses with green trousers and green headscarves, and everyone wears a red ribbon to honor the spiritual leaders.
68'de bir kalabalığı hatırlıyorum sadece.
Duran et al. First attended a ceremony like this when he was 6 or 7 years old. He barely remembers it. His family once led the village's spiritual life. As an adult, he served in the military for 24 years. After retiring, he returned to his hometown. He found that the community needed leadership.
Bu boşluğu doldurmam için halkımızın...
Erol says that people insisted that I help fill that gap. Eventually, I was convinced. He is now 64 and the head of the new Cemevi in Ayhanlar village. The return of the Cemevi here is part of an effort to bring back these spiritual gathering places after they were shut down long ago. Alevis make up about a quarter of Turkey's 85 million people. Their beliefs combine elements of Shia Islam, Sufism, and Anatolian folk traditions. In 1993, a mob set fire to the Madımak Hotel in Sivas, another city in central Turkey, killing 33 Alevi artists and thinkers. It was one of many attacks on Alevis, who were long labeled heretics.
Sünni İslam devletten çok büyük kaynaklar kullanıyor.
Erol says that Sünni İslam gets enormous support, but the Alevi community lacks those resources. In Turkey today, Sünni religious education is mandatory in schools. Jews and Christians can opt out of the lessons, though Alevis cannot.
Dediler ki ya bunlar bir türlü bizden olamıyor diyor dediler.
They decided, let's teach them our own faith when they are young. Maybe that way we can assimilate them, Erol says. The policy succeeded in some ways. Many young people drifted from Alevi culture. Some became Sunni, others lost interest in religion. Over the years, the government has made small efforts to celebrate Alevi culture. But many Alevis are skeptical. People like Duran Erol are stepping up to preserve their faith themselves.
Amacım, idealim, Alevi Bektaşi inancının bu köyde tekrardan...
My goal, my ideal, is for the Alevi Bektaşi faith to continue in our village, says Duran Erol. Today, the Cemevi is more than a prayer space. It's a home, especially for the village's youth. I meet with a group of young girls who practice semah there. One of the students, 13-year-old Ümmü Gülsüm Dağ, says that she sees the people at the Cemevi more often than her own family. As the evening winds down, the Cem ceremony ends with shared prayers and a communal meal called lokma. The Cem still happens just once a year, but for this village, it's more than ritual. It's a way to reclaim identity and faith after decades of silence. For young Alevis like Ümmü Gülsüm and Nurgül Nisa, it's a lifeline to their roots and a promise that the tradition will thrive. For the world, I'm Özge Sebzeci, Ayhanlar, Central Turkey.
And before we head out today, a little sports news. The 2025 World Aquatics Championships wrap up in Singapore this weekend with competitions in swimming, diving, and water polo.
Even with days to go still, multiple records have already been broken. Yesterday, French swimmer Leon Marchand set a new record in the semifinal for the men's 200-meter individual medley.
Sensational swim, Leon Marchand, new superstar. A world record, the first of the championships.
He clocked in at 1 minute 52.69 seconds, beating the previous record by more than a full second, which in this event is a lot. And that was in the semifinals. Today, Marchand took home the gold medal in the final.
On the women's side, Chinese swimmer Yu Zhidi has made waves, not for her speed, but for her age.
Yu Zhidi of China. She shouldn't be here. She's 12. Normally, you need to be at least 14 to compete at a senior worlds, but if you're fast enough, they'll waive the age limit, and the 12-year-old is and makes it.
12-year-old Zidi came in fourth in the 200-meter individual medley. Her team took home the bronze, though, in the 4x200-meter freestyle relay, making her the youngest swimmer ever to medal at the World Aquatics Championships.
Summer McIntosh of Canada fell just short of a world record for her time in the 200-meter butterfly, but she is still chasing 5 gold medals for individual events. Michael Phelps is the only swimmer to have done that at the World Championships. So far for McIntosh, it's 3 down, 2 to go.
McIntosh losing sight of that world record line, but no doubt about it, she'll make it. 3 races, 3 golds thus far in Singapore.
If she pulls it off, she'll be the first woman to earn that distinction.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. And find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Steve Henn, Dan Shi and Ted McGovern, Sharon G and Robert Ryan, and Frederica and Howard Stevenson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.